There is nothing Jewish about sacrificing the one place in the world that is meant for us.
The flag was hoisted before the world.
What does it mean to fight back? We have a long fight ahead of us.
Here I am.
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 With Shai Davidai.
One of the people that I've met and I've been so grateful to meet and call a friend and part of my community in the past 8 months is an Upper West Sider, a social media influencer, and just a strong Jewish woman. So here I am with Gabi Schiller, also known as Yehudim Omrim.
Hey, Shai.
How you doing?
Good. Thank you for such a wonderful introduction. I really appreciate it.
So, Gabi, I start every episode with probably the most obvious, but also the most non-obvious question, which is this. Gabi, what kind of a Jew are you?
What kind of a Jew am I? It's a good question. Probably a loud, confrontational Jew. That's what kind of a Jew I am. Probably not unlike yourself.
I wouldn't call myself confrontational. I would definitely call myself loud. Yes. But what do you mean when you say confrontational Jew?
Confrontational in the sense that if I and I have encountered anti-Semitism, I will say something on the spot, for better or worse. And to borrow a quote from someone I admire and look up to enormously, her name is Charlotte Korchak. She's a giant in this world. I would
and
rather...
she's an and Charlotte Korchak is an education coordinator at Stand With Us, which is where you work, right?
The international senior educator at Stand With Us, an organization I'm very, very proud to work at and represent, and I can get into a little bit later. But she has said, I would rather be punched in the face for being a proud Jew and not hide who I am than, you know, tuck my Magen David and, you know, hide my identity and not speak up for being a proud Jewish Zionist. Hmm.
So yeah, take me back to, you know, have you always been this way? Is this something that has been activated?
I think I've always been pretty loud and confrontational in nature. I have not always been involved in activism for the Jewish community and standing up for Israel by any means. My awakening, for many people, was October 7th. My awakening was May 2021, which was the last big, it wasn't really an all-out war, but the last big conflict between Israel and Hamas. And that was my, when the curtain fell for me, for how much people hated Israel, scapegoated Jews under the guise of progressive values. And that was what launched me into this world of not just social media, but actually what led my involvement into Stand With Us.
But why 2021? That wasn't the first, obviously, the first war between Israel and Hamas in Gaza. I assume that's not the first time you encountered hatred towards Israel, hatred towards Jews. What changed then?
It's interesting you ask that. In my world, it was because I grew up, let me take you back a little bit. I had a very stereotypical Jewish upbringing. I was raised in a conservative Jewish household. I went to Solomon Schechter Westchester, now called the LaFell School. And I think I took a lot of parts of my upbringing for granted in the sense that the Jewish world, the kehila, was all around me. And so in some ways I felt like it was sort of pushed in my face, and so I turned away from it. Mm-hmm. I did not feel connected to my community especially not in the capacity that I do now. I very much tuned out of the political dialogue around our Shabbat dinner table, around discussions about Israel and anti-Semitism, and especially when my school would bring in speakers. Every time I talk about this, it's such a full circle moment for me, because I was the kid in the back of the classroom when my school would bring in speakers, and now I'm going into high schools speaking to high school students about Israel and anti-Semitism. But I was the kid that was tuned out and on my cell phone, or would, you know, go and say I'd have to go to the bathroom for as long as I could to not have to listen. But I was always very connected to my Zadie, who was a Holocaust survivor, and very
Zadie
inspired.
For people that don't know Yiddish, Zadie is an cute word for grandpa.
Yes, it's the Yiddish word for grandfather. But I always considered his testimony and family history to be more history, not something relevant to my day-to-day life. So when the first college I went to was Skidmore College for 2 years, I surrounded myself with community that was not Jewish community. And then I happened to leave school, make Aliyah for reasons that, you know, were, I think part of me wanted to start being connected to the Jewish community, but not in the conventional, let me become a Zionist sense, but I was searching for who I was. And then when I came back to the U.S. and there was that period of COVID, I was very steeped into the online and TikTok world. That's when TikTok got very big. And I did not have good media literacy. I did not have a good understanding of the political world around me and where my progressive values aligned with my Jewish identity. So for the first time, I was really experiencing, once May 2021 happened, and I started seeing an explosion of content, both from strangers online and from acquaintances and friends I knew well, of, you know, Israel's a colonial state, the 4,000 rockets being launched into civilian territory is justified, we're celebrating it. I was shocked. This was all very new to me.
This was after you lived in Israel for a while.
This was after I'd made Aliyah, lived in Tel Aviv for over 2 years and came back. And that was my real awakening to all the things I had been told I would experience growing up. And then it finally hit me. I finally experienced it. Mm-hmm.
What was your, we know what you did as a reaction, we'll talk about that. Well, what was your emotional reaction as someone who's at the back of the room, I'm not interested, to all of a sudden seeing all these comments and content online? What was it?
I was actually speaking about this earlier on People Jew Wanna Know, another fantastic podcast. Yeah. But my immediate reaction was not to, it wasn't immediate activism. It was at first some questioning, because again, all the values I thought I held and the people I aligned with were, again, you know, the one thing they seemed to disagree on was Israel. So I had to...
How convenient.
Right, right. So again, it sent me on a long journey of questioning and re-educating myself, because all the classes that I had tuned out in high school, I had to take those lessons and take myself on a path of learning. So one of the questions I found myself confronting my parents with in this, I felt this crisis of, well, have I been lied to? Which is, I think, you know, I felt I was at this forked road. And maybe a lot of anti-Zionist Jews have felt that way too, but they choose to take a different path, one of propaganda, unfortunately, or choosing social acceptance over standing with their community and choosing nuance and painful, complicated reality over, you know, it's black and white, oppressor versus oppressed. So one of the questions I found myself asking my dad is, well, is it true that Jews are
are really tangibly archaeologically from Israel, not just this thing we made up in our religion. And he sort of laughed and said, you don't have to believe anything I say. Just go read about the Dead Sea Scrolls. That's to this day one of the reasons I'm so obsessed with the Dead Sea Scrolls. I've made a few videos.
So yeah, just so people that don't know what the Dead Sea Scrolls are, give it like a two second spiel. Why is that such a thing? You know, you'd imagine that someone who's looking to feel the connection of the archaeological connection of Jews to the land of Israel, they would talk about the Tower of David. They would talk about Din Sanya in Tel Dan, where's Hebrew, they'll be talking about King Hordas's palace that, you know, is documented where, you know, he said was there with the Jews. So why the Dead Sea Scrolls? What are they?
The Dead Sea Scrolls are ancient parchment papyrus scrolls that are nearly identical in text to the Torah, the Hebrew Bible that we as Jews use today, that were discovered by, I think it was Bedouins, and then studied by archaeologists in the Qumran caves right by the Dead Sea, and that were used by and studied by Jews over 2,000 years ago in the land of Israel, where the Jewish people were born as a people.
And correct me if I'm wrong, it's not just that, but they were in the Qumran caves because they were hiding, right? They were hiding their Jewishness even back then. They wanted to practice freely and at the time couldn't. So that was their fight for Jewish civil rights. That was their resistance.
Yeah, I also believe it was a specific sect,
yes,
that went and hid out. The exact details of why they ended up in the caves, I'd have to go and reacquaint myself with. But it's one of my favorite pieces of archaeology to talk about, because it just blows to smithereens this idea of Jews being colonial or foreign to this land, again, where they formed as a people. And it gives me chills, honestly, to think about, we have preserved our identity, our language, for over 2,000 years. And here you have this physical artifact that shows you that very idea. And for people to have a movement based on trying to discredit that, when you have that physical evidence right in front of you, it's insane.
So yeah, so 2021, you are shocked by what you're seeing. You are reacquainting yourself with the classes that you kind of napped in the back of class. And then you choose your own path of fighting back. What's that path?
That path is, at first, social media. This is a time I'm sort of transitioning, going back to school. So it's still COVID. You know, it's that awkward period of time where people are in the midst of COVID, but slowly going back to in-person spaces. So I had started to go back to school, where first I re-enrolled as a non-matriculated student and then went back to study at Hunter College, and the next year would go back on campus. So I started the year before I went back on campus, I was starting online activism as a means to feel I had to speak up for the Jewish people, because there are 15 million of us. We're 15.7, we're less than 0.5% of the world. And then I continued because I did not feel I had a space on campus that was doing that. I felt very let down by my Hillel's leadership. And as I continued speaking out online on social media, I connected with an amazing group of other activists. And one in particular, we connected and she asked me, you know, have you ever heard of Stand With Us? And I said, of course, I've seen them on social media. And she told me about the
Emerson Fellowship, which is their college campus program. And I jumped at the chance at enrolling because I was desperate for a communal space where I could be involved with and do programming and other resources and tools to continue what I was doing beyond just the digital sphere.
So, and then you became an Emerson Fellow at Stand With Us. Then you graduated and you joined as a full-time employee.
Yes. Now I am the New England High School Regional Manager. I work in the high school department.
Tell me about that. I think a lot of people have been hearing and following what's happening in colleges. Many Jews and many non-Jews are confused. They are scared. They're trying to make sense of it. Yet these college students are not coming out of thin air. They come out of high schools. You work with the Jewish kids that are in those high schools. What's happening in high schools? What's happening in the 15 to 18 age range?
Yeah, as you mentioned, there is a lot of much needed attention in the college campus space because it's atrocious now. It's atrocious everywhere, but I think a lot of people fail to realize they are coming from, it is coming from the K through 12 space. And I see it day in and day out with these kids I work with in the high school space. Now, I specifically work with teens in New England. There are 9 other staff members that do what I do throughout the country. In the US, there's another one in Canada. And every day there are different anti-Semitic reports that I am responding to.
Give me some examples. Like, what are you responding to?
Swastika graffitis in the bathroom. A girl who flipped off an intern, a student that I work with, because she's an outspoken Israeli student and not afraid to speak up on social media and in the classroom. Sometimes it comes from the administration, and sometimes it is not blatant Jew hatred in the way that we think when I might say an anti-Semitic report, but sometimes, you know, especially in the wake of October 7th, schools either didn't address the Hamas attacks at all, or they made a really wishy-washy statement that didn't even say Israel or Hamas. And think of how that left Jewish and Israeli students feeling, because the message is very clear. It is, we know we have to say something, but we're not really going to name what happened because it's too controversial to talk about the largest massacre of Jews since the Holocaust.
But I actually don't know what a 15 or 16-year-old high schooler in New England, like a Jewish kid, would react to this. Like, what were their reactions? The Jewish kids that you work with every day, like, how are they experiencing this?
It depends on the student and it depends on the school. So some schools, and, you know, for privacy reasons, for their sake, I can't really name the student and the school. But, you know, some schools we can work with and there will be a willingness to work with us and improve and be, they are willing to work with our speakers, to work with our resources, to be open to adopting the IHRA definition of anti-Semitism. But it also depends on how much action the student is willing to take. You know, do they want to get in front of media? Do they want to sit in a meeting with myself and the principal and the superintendent? So the reaction is dependent on the nature of the incident. Did it directly affect them, one of their friends? Did it happen on school grounds? Did it happen right outside the school? Do they feel, you know, that I can actually help them? So it's very dependent. I know this sort of sounds like a roundabout answer, but it is dependent on the incident, the student, and the school.
Right. But to me, it does not sound like a roundabout answer. It sounds like something that we have been dealing with for months now, where when it comes to a Jewish kid's experience or a Jewish adult's experience, it depends on where, when, how, and why. Whereas with other groups, when their civil rights are being infringed, when they're being attacked, the answer is immediately like, this is not okay, period. Now let's focus on the details rather than the other way around.
Correct. And I think right off the bat, it's easy to say that the double standard is clear. It's clear in all of these institutions. I've been working with maybe one or two schools that have been very attentive in their post-October 7th responses and their willingness to work with, if not us, then other Jewish organizations. Wonderful. It does not need to be us, but a willingness to work with organizations that can provide resources to acknowledge and alleviate Jewish students' fear of their safety and if not safety, concern of being in classrooms with students that are being malicious to them inside the classroom and outside the classroom on social media. But many schools have just sort of taken a stance of, well, this is too controversial. There's nothing we can really do. Both sides have a right to free speech. And as you and I very much know, that this, under the guise of free speech, hate speech arises and blatant attacks, harassment, and bullying.
So I'm going to do something that's very atypical for me. Instead of focusing on the negative, let's focus on the positive for a second. You mentioned there's one or two schools that are getting it right. What are they doing right? Let's say that there's a principal listening. I hope for many principals or teachers listening, and they want to say, you know what? I want to make sure that the Jewish kids in my school feel as safe and protected as any other kid. What should they be doing? What have the schools that have been getting it right been doing?
The main thing I will say is a willingness to stay in conversation because schools will not always get it right. I know that also sounds like a really, like, that sounds like a wishy-washy answer, but administrations cannot always control their students. But will they stay in conversations with us and be open to hearing feedback of, okay, this didn't work, bringing in this speaker didn't work, let's try this, or let's try adopting the, again, the IHRA definition of anti-Semitism as a guideline so we know exactly what constitutes as anti-Semitism towards Jewish students. Okay, we implemented this. Now we're still seeing repeat offenders in schools. Now we take the next step, which is, so we don't feel that we are fighting with administrations. And the idea of our organization is not to go in and tell schools, hey, you're getting it wrong and we're here to punish you. We're an education organization. That is our mission. And we're trying to partner with schools to bring in education, bring in more curriculum around the Jewish community, modern day anti-Semitism, Holocaust education. And as long as schools are open to staying in dialogue with us and not skirting around the issue, that's the most important first step. Getting it, what the exact answer is in terms of are there going to continue being anti-Semitic incidents? Probably. I mean, students are being indoctrinated in many places in classrooms, on social media, but are they taking the necessary steps with us in addressing it and then enforcing policy?
All right, so that's what you do, that's your day job. But unlike many, many social media influencers, your day job is fighting for the Jews, and yet you, at some point during the day, you turn off that part of you and you activate the same goal, but now you personally, as Gabi, tell me about that. What do you do on social media? And why did you choose the name Yehudim Omrim, which literally translates to Jews say?
So, to answer your first question, what I do on social media, I post about different issues pertaining to the Jewish community. And it's interesting, I will post about Israel and anti-Semitism, but not just things directly about Israel or directly about anti-Semitism. I just put up a post actually about the UN. And I posted about it because the UN, as we know, as an international body, disproportionately targets Israel. And especially in this war, after October 7th, we have seen a lot of people referencing the UN and how they go after Israel in their war of self-defense against Hamas. And so I wanted to make a post specifically about the UN and their hypocrisy about their own human rights abuses in order to highlight, okay, well, the UN is not necessarily a credible body at all when it comes to human rights. So this is an issue that does affect the Jewish community, that does affect people who talk about Israel. So that's what I do on my social media. Why did I choose Yehudim Omrim? Because while I represent myself, I also would like to think I represent a lot of Jews who are looking for a way to talk about these issues pertaining to activism around the Jewish community, but not only your very classic go-to Hezbollah. And I wanted to find a way to say, like, I'm speaking for a lot of us. Obviously not all Jews. I have to say that. I am not speaking for all Jews. But, you know, the ones that follow me, I think they share a lot of my sentiment. So
let's talk about the Jews you don't speak for.
Oh, yeah.
And specifically, you tend to post quite a bit about quote-unquote anti-Zionist Jews.
Yeah.
And I have noticed something going through your posts for the past months and maybe years. You have become more increasingly angrier. And especially increasingly angrier about either anti-Zionist Jews as a group or specific individuals like Jonathan Navel Glazer, who obviously had this horrible speech when he accepted the Oscar. What is the nerve that they're touching?
I'm pausing for silence because I'm trying to
calm yourself.
Calm myself.
You don't have to calm yourself. This is, I think people want to know how you feel, not just what you think.
Am I allowed to swear on here?
You are recommended, yes.
Okay.
It's recommended that you do.
My boss wasn't coming. Because how fucking dare you is how I feel. I want to get ahead of the argument, and not how dare you have empathy and compassion for people who have been killed in a war, but it's funny. One of the first people that come to mind, it's people that I grew up with, and I know it's not just the nameless, faceless anti-Zionist Jew mouthing off on Twitter. I don't really care about them. It's the people I know. I will not name them also for the sake of people I love. But how dare you throw people you know and love under the bus like this?
Yeah, because... but they will argue, what do you mean? We are being really Jewish. Right? That's their whole point.
No.
I disagree with them, but they're saying we are doing tikkun olam. We are fighting for justice, and you, Gabi, you claim to be Jewish, but you're actually detracting us. Like, what?
What is Jewish about sacrificing the Jewish people? What is Jewish about that? There is nothing Jewish about sacrificing the one place in the world that is meant for us. And it's not that it is meant for us and Palestinians can't have it too. It is that how dare you be so selective about the one place
that has been a refuge for people like my Zadie, for Mizrahim who fled Arab societies and were persecuted with assistance from the Nazis and Arabs, mind you. But how dare you ignore reality because it feels good to be kumbaya and socially accepted because this is a view adopted by the rest of the world? No, this is not what reality is. The reality is that who, like Douglas Murray said the other day, who is going to protect the Jews? You think if Israel gets dissolved, that the Europeans will protect us? Zimbabwe, the Arab world, what happens, right? We know what comes next.
So why don't they know?
I think it's not a matter of knowing. It's a matter of, it's inconvenient and it doesn't feel good, and it feels good to live in a world of pretending that maybe if we just pretended if Israel could join hands with Palestinians and we all lived in a happy democratic society like Breonna Joy Gray, the psychosis of it, I can't even begin to bring myself to understand that Hamas just wants to make a democracy. I mean, her, I think she's really beyond saving.
I mean, I think if Hamas wanted to create a democracy, they would start in Gaza first, right?
Right. But it's this unwillingness to accept and see long-term, because the short-term of looking at a very real and painful war that is causing suffering for people hurts. But it stops at, you know, the thinking stops at B when you have to think all the way to Z. And it's really hard to look at that suffering. And, you know, I think you and I and pretty much anyone who's Jewish and vocal online gets comments every day like, you love genocide. Right. You know what? I love opening my phone and seeing, you know, injured children and babies. Like, of course, that is sickening. It tears at the heart. No one wants to see that. And no one values those lives less. And it is not a but, it is an and, that I will not accept that my people will not have a homeland for themselves to protect them from the global persecution and extermination that the world has vowed they will enact towards the Jewish people, as history has shown since the formation of the Jewish people.
And that's something that seems to loom really large in a lot of what you do, which is the memory of past atrocities, and especially the Holocaust.
Yeah. It does. My Zadie and what he lived through fuels a lot of what I do. Fuels most of what I do. And keeping his testimony alive. And I have to say, I hate how anti-Zionists have weaponized that. Because there's a lot of...
When you say weaponized what?
Because there's a lot of grossly morbid dialogue from them around, well, Jews and Zionists have not been able to move past the trauma of the Holocaust and being able to, you know, accept Palestinian liberation. And that is why they're Zionist, and that is why there's Jewish supremacy. And it's a very kind of sick premise, right? First of all, of course, Jews, I think, are still traumatized from the Holocaust. That trauma is intergenerational.
But there are literally people that lived through the Holocaust that are still, you know,
right,
experiencing.
That are still alive.
We're living in a society where if you called me something that I didn't want to be called, I can say that you traumatized me. And yet, of course, you would have people that went through one of the most horrific atrocities of the 20th century, who are still around and will be traumatized, and their kids will be traumatized. That's, of course.
Right. But it's more than that. It's more that, why is intergenerational trauma accepted and permissible for other groups of people, but it's not permissible of Jews, without then demonizing us as a group of people who then still can't have empathy and not be capable of nuance in discussing the Israeli-Palestinian conflict? Do you understand what I'm driving at? It's that there, when you look at how they discuss the subject, it's that Zionism is not, you know, it comes in a few, from a few different angles. It's Zionism is born out of supremacy, X, Y, Z, but it's also born out of, you know, their trauma from the Holocaust, and that is why they're not able to see Palestinians as people. Like, no, there is, you know, there, sure, there is trauma that is embedded within the subject, and we can still, are still people that are capable of talking about Palestinians, Palestinian rights, where the Israeli government goes wrong. You know, there's a lot of ands that is possible in this conversation.
You keep going. I don't know if you notice, a lot of what you say is X and Y, this and that. You don't hear that a lot. Why?
You know, for a society that is very obsessed with non-binaries, we certainly live in a very time of binary thinking, oppressed versus oppressor, colonized and colonizer, because it's not as desperately as people wish this conflict fit into neat categories and boxes. It doesn't. It doesn't. And it is not a but, it is an and.
So let's go back away from Israel, Gaza, the West Bank, and to the streets of New York City. When things really took a turn at Columbia University, that hit you very, very hard. Even though you don't attend Columbia, you live close by, but not in the neighborhood. But you took that personally. Why?
Well, one, you know, you and your dad and noises of the city. Sorry.
Yeah, let's wait a second and.
Can I actually?
All right. Yes. Okay. So let me ask again, just so you know, to get you in the mindset. So when things took a really dark turn at Columbia, you seem to have taken it personally, even though you don't attend, never attended Columbia. You live in the city, but not in Columbia's neighborhood. And yet, when I first saw you, and maybe even didn't see you, maybe I was talking with you on the phone, you were crying. You took that really, really hard. Now, of course, you know me, you know what I've been going through, but it was more than that. You weren't, it didn't seem like you were crying for me. It seemed like you were crying for you, for something else.
Yeah.
What were you crying for?
It was, I know what moment you're referring to. And it was when the footage of James Khamenei, who was one of the encampment leaders, started doing this call and repeat to the whole encampment once two Jewish students entered and started calling out to them. You know, we have Zionists have entered the camp.
Infiltrated, I think that was his word.
Right, infiltrated the camp. And then they barricaded the two students around. I don't know if I will fully be able to put into words the feeling of horror and fear that invoked in me. I felt like, can the world not see the parallels of Nazism that is right here in what is supposed to be the most liberal city in the world? An entire mob of students doing a call and repeat at, what I was seeing was just a whole bunch of people doing a Sieg Heil. And I mean, in that moment, I was so glad my Zaidi was not alive and that the burden was on me and it was on us.
What would your Zaidi have said?
I mean, first of all, I don't think he would have been surprised. He always said there was going to be something like another Holocaust in the U.S., that it always comes back for the Jews. But just that moment. And there since then have been other attempts to barricade students at UCLA, at NYU. I've seen footage of it, but just that one clip in particular was so haunting and was terrifying. I don't know how anyone, no matter what academic language you try and cloak it in, social progressivism you try, whatever spin you try and put on, I don't know how anyone can try and see it for what it was, which was, you know, the harassment and physical intimidation of Jewish students based on being Jewish by a mob of people in one of the most elite universities of the world.
And yet, most people who saw that video, and that video was very, very widely circulated, and this is before the other video of the same student leader came out of him calling, of them calling to kill Zionists and that Zionists shouldn't live. Most people who saw that video did not have the reaction that you nor I had. Why do you think that's the case?
I think that a lot of people, when it comes to speaking up and having to acknowledge what is right in front of them, it takes bravery and it takes inconveniencing themselves. And people don't want to inconvenience themselves. It takes one of the biggest, I think one of the biggest buy-ins for people of the pro-Palestinian, which has become pro-Hamas movements, is social acceptance. There are few things more powerful than being accepted by society around you. And that's also why I like to talk a lot about August Landmesser on my page. There's that famous photo in the 1930s. You see a whole crowd of people doing the Heil Hitler salute, and then you see that one man with his arms crossed. Everyone like think I would have been that guy. I would have been, you know, that person who wouldn't have gone with the crowd. No, you wouldn't. No, you wouldn't. Because that takes not only thinking for yourself, but being willing to stand in a crowd and everybody telling you you're wrong, you're the bad guy. And no one wants to be told they're evil. You're the colonizer. You're the disgrace to the human race. Are you kidding me? So these are the people who are following the crowd. And there's nothing more powerful than being accepted by the people around you.
And you, as your work with high schoolers, that's probably the time in life where being accepted by the crowd is the most important, the most critical. Social death in high school, teen years, maybe in college, is probably the worst kind of punishment that people can experience. How do you strengthen the Jewish high schoolers that you work with? How do you help them be the person who does not give the salute, who does not go with the crowd?
Well, what I will say is the students I work with are incredibly bright and I mean, amazing, amazing kids. They are not crowd followers at all, but of course, you know, they have struggled with friendships and relationships during this period of time. And I feel for them. Like, that's not something anyone should go through, let alone a high schooler in your formative years. It's horrible. And so I think the question I get the most is, when I present, when I speak in schools, when I speak anywhere, is, you know, I had a friend that posted this thing on Instagram. You know, does that mean I shouldn't be their friend anymore? And I can't answer that question for them, especially because most of the people I speak to, they already have excellent values. You know, these are not students who I am worried about in any sense. These are leaders in their community already. It's more just, how do I navigate these tumultuous relationships? And the advice I try to give them is, you know, can you actually have dialogue with these people? Are they interested in having dialogue? Because there's different categories of people. There's ignorant, there's people who want to learn, who may not agree with everything you're saying, but, you know, can meet you halfway. And especially being in high school, where you're sort of bombarded with one narrative, and then you have your Jewish friend that comes to you and says, like, actually, are you willing to hear about how this hurts me? If they're willing to have that conversation, then, you know, I think you're in a good spot. But these, again, the students I work with are really just amazing stand-up kids.
And what do you tell their parents? If at all, I assume you get this a lot. I get this from many parents of graduating high schoolers and college students, of like, where do we send our kids? How do we help them? How do we protect them? What do you tell parents, Jewish parents of high schoolers, and I assume some non-Jewish parents who just want their kids to go to high school and not have to deal with hate just roaming free in the hallways and in the schoolyard?
Interestingly enough, I have not spoken a whole lot with parents. My relationship has really been heavily focused on with my students themselves. And I think they have probably been having that conversation more so with their parents, but in the conversation around colleges and campuses, what we have told them, and not just myself, but, you know, when we have our national meetings, and that's when all the regions come together, it's that you can't at this point avoid anti-Semitism on campus, but you want to be paying attention to how administrations respond. That's our main piece of advice to them. Because
what signs should they be looking for?
Do they enforce policy? Do they work closely with their Chabad or their Hillel, although Hillels themselves can vary on campus. What do other Jewish students on campus have to say? You know, is there a good population of Jewish students, and what has their experience been? Talk to the Jewish students when you go visit. That's a big one. So honestly, campuses can really, it can change at any given year, given who is accepted. You know, you might have no SJP at a college campus, and then a student comes and then they open an SJP chapter. So it can differ at any point, but how does the administration respond? Ask them, how do you respond to protests? And, you know, at what point do protests cross a line for you? Ask them all the questions that you expect answers to.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of Jewish parents they don't even know what questions to ask now. Everything is so confusing. Everything is so outside of our comfort zone. And I can tell you as a parent, all you want to do is just cocoon your children and keep them safe, while knowing that if you cocoon them, they won't grow, they won't become the strong and resilient people that we want them to be. So asking the right questions, I think, is a really good first step.
Yeah.
In your mind, what does the future hold for Israel and for the Jews?
Israel's not going anywhere, much to the dismay of these worldwide protesters. Israel's not going anywhere. I am worried for Israelis because they have been through the unimaginable. There are still, I think, 100,000 internally displaced Israelis, which you won't hear about when the media talks about the war, because who gives a crap about the internally displaced Israelis? You still have hostage families desperate for any bit of news, waiting for the hostages to come home, to be returned. And you can't even say that Israelis are going through PTSD, because they are still going through the trauma. So I am worried about that, and then with the Northern Front heating up. But in terms of if Israel will continue to exist, Israel will be fine, but we are going through a very hard time. And the way we get through it is we keep speaking up and leaning on each other as a community. I always wear my dog tag out in public. I wear my Magen David. I actually made a post about this the other day when I was visiting New Orleans, and I just came back the other day from it. I was walking with my dog tag, and you know, one of those Israeli sales guys from outside a soap store spotted me with my dog tag. He's like, "Oh my God, I love you so much!" Like,
can you do the accent if you're gonna tell the story?
I don't know if I can even do it. He's like, "Oh my God, I love you so much for this." Like, you know. And then he brought me inside, and he gifted me a free soap thing, like, while the owner wasn't looking. And we just gave each other a hug. He was like, "Beyachad ninatzeach," you know. And just these moments are what push us forward into a very scary future.
Right. There's, for us, that's the way I think about it. That's the way I think about the future of the fight for Jewish civil rights, which is we need to have some sort of symbol when we see each other on the street, and we immediately know we are in this fight together. And it's the Magen David, it's the dog tag, it's the chai, it's the chamsa, it's the Hebrew name that people have sometimes. It's something to let each other know. This time we're not letting them mark us. We are marking ourselves, because we need to be together in this fight.
Amen, amen, amen. Yeah. Amen.
So I like to finish every episode with what I've been calling a Jewish lightning round.
Oh.
series of questions. There's no right or wrong answers. It's just the first answer that comes to mind. You get one pass if you want to pass a question, and I get to decide if you get that pass or not.
Oh,
All
okay. I'm scared now.
right, Gabby. What is one thing people don't know about you?
That I have a habit of switching letters, litching sweaters.
That is so freakingly weird because I know that you've been very close with my wife, Yarden. She does the exact same thing in Hebrew.
What?
Yes, that's what she does to calm herself when she's anxious. What is one thing people don't know about the Jews?
That even though we celebrate Shavuot, most of us cannot handle the cheese.
Gabby, when was the last time you cried?
I cry so much. Yesterday.
What happened?
I was stressed after traveling, and I think I stubbed my toe. It wasn't even a big thing.
We're all at the edge of our
Yeah,
abilities.
yeah.
What's your favorite Jewish holiday?
I think, even though I kind of hate it when we're going through it, Pesach, because there's something about the family gathering, and I love the Seder, but I hate it, but I also love it. That's it, yeah.
What's your least favorite Jewish holiday?
Yom Kippur, sorry.
When do you feel safest?
When my dad is giving me a pep talk.
When do you feel least safe?
When I'm about to get a migraine.
What gives you hope?
Seeing all the new Jewish voices, specifically Jewish youth that are speaking out in the face of so much hate, and they are the August landmassers of our time.
Anyone specific comes to mind, and it's okay if not.
I think of my students. Obviously, they're amazing college campus activists, like Eden Yedigar, but my students, and I don't know if it's for privacy reasons if I can
Yeah,
name them,
of
but
course.
I'm so moved by them.
Finally, every episode, I urge the listeners to donate to one charity that does good in Israel or across the Jewish diaspora. Where would you want people to donate to this week?
One of the first places I ever started donating was the Blue Card. It is a 501c3 that helps feed and give the necessary things that Holocaust survivors need, because most of them, over 50% of them, still live below the poverty line. So I would say the Blue Card. There are still many, many incredible, necessary charities that are helping displaced families in Israel. So still many of those, but the Blue Card has a special place in my heart.
Amazing. Gabby, where can people find you?
On Instagram, Yehudim Omrim.
Do you want to spell that out?
So Yehudim, Yehudim, Omrim, Omrim.
Well, I must say that this for me was a personal, absolute pleasure. I am so grateful that you have found yourself into my life, that I found myself my way into your life. I really don't know how this fight would have been, how high I would have been in this fight if not for knowing you. And so here I am with Gabi Schiller. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Shai. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Michael Greenspan, Shai's father-in-law. I'd like to thank you for listening to the Here I Am podcast with Shai Davidai. Here I Am is recorded at The Cave Production House in Hackensack, New Jersey, and is brought to you in partnership with Abby Sophia and Adamit Productions. You can find us on Instagram, YouTube, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. I'd also like to extend my deepest gratitude to everyone at Adamit Productions for turning Shai's dream into a reality, and to all our donors and partners for their unwavering commitment to fighting for Jewish civil rights. Most importantly, I'd like to thank you, our listeners. Let's be honest, none of this would have been possible without your support and dedication. Showing up is half the battle. Thank you for showing up. Thank you for being there. Thank you for saying, "Here I am."